From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Invece siamo stati coperti da una pioggia di fuoco, una cosa assolutamente.
But then suddenly, we found ourselves under an immense amount of bullets, something terrible. Without any warning, and we realized that nearby there was an American tank which was shooting at us.
Che ci stava sparando addosso.
Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena thought she was headed to freedom after being held for a month by the Iraqi resistance. U.S. troops opened fire, wounding her and killing the Italian intelligence official who helped free her. We'll go to Italy to speak with one of the founders of Segrena's newspaper, Il Manifesto. Then the presidents of Syria and Lebanon meet to approve a withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon.
Outside world, they believe that there are only two forces in Lebanon, the allies of Syria or the government and the opposition to Syria. I would say that there is the silent majority in Lebanon. They are for the withdrawal of the Syrian troops from Lebanon. They have been for this since after the war, but they're not for their withdrawal according to the current terms. And definitely they are not for the intervention of the Americans or the French or any other international force in the politics of Lebanon.
And today is the 40th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the historic voting rights march in Selma, Alabama. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A state funeral was held today in Rome for the Italian intelligence official shot dead by U.S. forces in Iraq. The agent, Nicola Calipari, was escorting Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena, who had just been released by hostage takers in Baghdad. Segrena is a reporter for the communist daily Il Manifesto. She was hit with shrapnel in the shoulder during the attack by U.S. forces. Calipari, who is the international operations chief of Italy's military intelligence service, was reportedly killed as he tried to shield Segrena from the bullets. In a vivid account published by her newspaper, Il Manifesto, Segrena described how Calipari was shot in the head, writing, quote, "I heard his last breath as he died on top of me." Thousands of Italians lined the streets today as the funeral procession moved through Rome. Segrena's recovering in a Rome hospital and said she is very sad not to be able to attend the ceremony. Meanwhile, outrage at the U.S. continues to build in Italy as more details emerge on last Friday's attack. The U.S. military said the car carrying Segrena and the Italian agents was speeding to the airport as it approached a checkpoint. A statement issued by the military said soldiers shot into the engine block after trying to warn the driver to stop, quote, by hand and arm signals, flashing white lights, and firing warning shots in front of the car. But Segrena said that version's absolutely false, telling an Italian television channel, quote, "There was no bright light, no signal," and adding that the car was traveling at regular speed. Segrena said she believes she may have been targeted because of U.S. opposition to Italy's policy on hostage negotiations, which many believe involves the paying of ransoms. The Italian government has virtually admitted a ransom was paid, with a senior official saying it was very likely. An Iraqi member of parliament told Belgian state television Saturday that a $1 million ransom was paid, but Italian media reports spoke of a payment of up to $8 million. Segrena says before she was released, her hostage takers had warned her the U.S. did not want her to return to Italy alive. She said she just took that as one final threat from her captors until the convoy started making its way to the airport. She says that without warning or provocation, U.S. troops opened fire on the car. We'll get more from Segrena's newspaper, Il Manifesto, in a few minutes. Bolivian President Carlos Mesa has announced he is resigning from office amid threats of widespread protests against corporate and government abuse of Bolivia's natural resources. Mesa's only been in office some 17 months after his predecessor, Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada, fled the country following large-scale protests in October 2003. Mesa himself has faced hundreds of protests over his government's policies on water, natural gas, and other resources. In the days preceding Mesa's announcement, a nationwide mobilization was underway for large-scale protests aimed at forcing changes in rules governing Bolivia's vast natural gas resources. Mesa said the protests would force the country to its knees. Already, there are blockades in various areas of Bolivia, and there have been clashes between police and anti-government demonstrators. This news from Iraq: a series of attacks today across the country have left scores of people dead, dozens wounded. A suicide bomber blew up his car outside the house of an Iraqi army officer in Balad, north of Baghdad, killing at least 15 people. Several nearby houses were also damaged by the blast. Balad is on the road between Baghdad and the resistance stronghold of Samarra. Guerrillas have mounted frequent attacks in the area. There were more deaths in Bakuba, where resistance fighters launched a series of apparently coordinated attacks that killed 7 soldiers and 5 police officers. The attacks included a car bomb, 3 roadside bombs, and small arms attacks. Monday's violence came a day after politicians set March 16th for the opening of Iraq's parliament as a deal hardened Sunday to name Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani to the presidency. The day marks the anniversary of the 1988 chemical attack on the northern Kurdish town of Halabja, which reportedly killed 5,000 people. The Lebanese defense minister says the redeployment of Syrian troops in Lebanon will begin today. Abdelrahim Raad said forces will pull back to the eastern Bekaa Valley, beginning a 2-stage withdrawal. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad meets his Lebanese counterpart today to discuss the details. The U.S. says the redeployment didn't go far enough, while Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has denounced what it called foreign intervention in Lebanon. Hezbollah called for a massive popular gathering on Tuesday against a U.N. resolution demanding the withdrawal of foreign forces from Lebanon. The head of Hezbollah said the group would not lay down its arms because Lebanon needed it as a defense against Israel. President Assad announced the redeployment on Saturday after weeks of intensifying international pressure to withdraw. It's estimated the first step of the redeployment involves up to 5,000 soldiers, then some 15,000 troops would pull back to the border itself. Now to the ongoing prisoner abuse scandal. Internal Army records released Friday show an Army intelligence sergeant who accused fellow soldiers in Samarra, Iraq, of abusing detainees in 2003, was in turn accused by his commander of being delusional and ordered to undergo a psychiatric evaluation in Germany. This despite a military psychiatrist's initial judgment that the man was stable. According to the Washington Post, the soldier had angered his commander by urging the unit's redeployment from the military base to prevent what the soldier feared would be the death of one or more detainees under interrogation. He told his commander 3 members of the counterintelligence team had hit detainees, pulled their hair, tried to asphyxiate them, and staged mock executions with pistols pointed at the detainees' heads. In another case detailed in the Army files, soldiers in a Florida National Guard unit deployed near Ramadi in 2003 compiled a 20-minute video that depicted a soldier kicking a wounded detainee in the face and chest in the presence of 10 colleagues and soldiers positioning a dead insurgent to appear to wave hello. The video was found in a soldier's computer files under the heading Ramadi Madness, and it initially prompted military lawyers to recommend charges of assault with battery and dereliction of duty for tampering with a corpse. These cases were among 13 described in more than 1,000 pages of Army criminal records released at the Pentagon under the order of a New York federal judge. They detail the Army's investigations of other allegations by U.S. military personnel in Iraq of abuse, rape, and larceny by fellow soldiers. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez said Saturday he had evidence that the United States is planning to assassinate him. On a visit to New Delhi, Chavez said, quote, "If anything happens to me, the person responsible will be the President of the United States." On February 20th, Chavez said the United States was plotting to kill him, and his foreign minister said 3 days later that U.S. accusations against Chavez were a sign of an impending attack. Washington dismissed the allegations, calling them wild charges. On Friday, Chavez said his country would not stop supplying oil to the United States unless, quote, the U.S. government gets a little bit crazy and tries to hurt us. During a speech in India Saturday, Chavez cited a report by Iraq's health ministry that claimed U.S. forces in Iraq had used mustard gas and nerve gas during their assault on the town of Fallujah last year. Chavez condemned the U.S. for its continuing occupation. Victims of the 2004 Asian tsunami plan to sue the United States government for failing to warn tourists of the disaster as it swept across Thailand, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and other countries. The legal papers filed in Manhattan federal court accuse the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, which measures earthquakes, tsunamis, and other earth movements, of being asleep as thousands perished December 26th. The petition was filed by the tsunami victims group, consisting mostly of Austrian and German families who lost loved ones in one of the world's worst natural disasters. The Texas-based hotel chain, the Accor Group, and the Kingdom of Thailand are also listed as possible defendants. To date, more than 273,000 people are believed dead or missing. And prior to Martha Stewart's release from federal prison last week, there was a lot of speculation about her physical appearance after her time behind bars. But one magazine took the speculation a bit further. On its cover this week, Newsweek magazine features what appears to be a photo of Martha Stewart, but is actually an image combining a photo of her face and one of a model's body. An editor at the magazine said the idea was to portray Stewart as she may have appeared when she emerged from prison. The editor said that a credit on page 3 with the table of contents of the magazine made clear the image on the cover was a composite. Newsweek labeled it a, quote, photo illustration. On the Nature of Daylight, Max Richter. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A state funeral was held today in Rome for the Italian intelligence official shot dead by U.S. forces in Iraq. Last Friday, the soldiers in Iraq shot at the car of Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena, killing the Secret Service intelligence official and wounding three others. Italian intelligence official Nicola Calipari was killed as he tried to protect Segrena from the bullets. Segrena was wounded in the shoulder. Segrena was kidnapped in Baghdad and has been held captive since February 4th by a group calling themselves Mujahideen Without Borders. She had just been released and handed over to three Italian agents on Friday when the car was shot at as they drove to Baghdad airport. In an interview with Sky Italia, Segrena described what happened.
Ma noi stavamo andando verso l'aeroporto e pensavamo di essere finalmente al sicuro perché la zona in cui ci trovavamo è già.
We were on our way to the airport and we thought we were finally safe because the area where we were was under the control of the United States.
In una zona più o meno amica, anche se naturalmente c'era sempre l'inquietudine.
We therefore thought we had escaped the gravest area and entered into a more friendly area, although I was still nervous as my hostage takers had warned me to be careful because it was the Americans who did not want me to be free and return to Italy alive.
E proprio però insomma mentre cercavamo di esorcizzare queste ultime paure.
I just took that as a last threat from my hostage takers and didn't really take it seriously. But then suddenly, we found ourselves under an immense amount of bullets, something terrible, without any warning, and we realized that nearby there was an American tank which was shooting at us.
Giuliana Segrena in an interview. The U.S. military has a different story. They say the car was speeding as it approached a checkpoint. In a statement, the military claims soldiers first tried to warn the driver to stop by, quote, hand and arm signals, flashing white lights, and firing warning shots in front of the car. In an interview with an Italian TV channel, Giuliana Segrena disputed the military's account, stating there was no bright light, no signal, that the car was traveling at regular speed. She also told Italian television that a ransom was paid for her release and it was possible she was deliberately targeted by U.S. forces. She said, quote, the fact that the Americans don't want negotiations to free hostages is known. The fact they do everything to prevent the adoption of this practice to save the lives of people held hostages, everybody knows that. So I don't see why I should rule out that I could have been a target, Segrena said. The Pentagon has said only the incident is under investigation. Joining us now on the telephone from Rome is Luciana Castellina. She is one of the founders of Giuliana Segrena's newspaper, Il Manifesto. She's just returned from the state funeral of Nicola Calipari, the intelligence official who was killed. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's very good to have you on Democracy Now! Again, can you describe the funeral today and the atmosphere in Rome?
Well, I would say that the funeral, first of all, there were thousands and thousands of people who attended the funeral. And since yesterday, where the coffin had been exposed in Piazza Venezia, there was a long, long queue which lasted for hours because everybody wanted to go and just make an homage to Nicola. He is called Nicola now by everybody, which is his name, and because everybody was so grateful because he sacrificed his life. So the funeral was, I would say, very human. Everybody was there, from the government, the opposition, all the institutions, the family, the friends, the representatives of the church, of everybody. And I think it was quite human because I think the Italian government was quite embarrassed, because they found themselves in a, well, you know, I mean, one of the best and more loved men of the Secret Service, which had sacrificed his life, has been killed by an American bullet. It's not an easy situation.
Can you talk about how high up in intelligence he was, the title International Operations Chief of Italy's Military Intelligence Service, certainly a position that I'm sure was often criticized by Il Manifesto, your newspaper.
The services, you mean, in general?
I'm saying that Nicola Calipari, the fact that he was the chief of international operations of Italy's military intelligence service, he was, I'm sure, often a target of criticism of your newspaper, Il Manifesto.
Well, I must say, you see, the service, secret services, nobody trusts entirely the secret service of your own country, do you? We didn't. But with Nicola, for a month, a human relation, nearly a friend relation was established because the editor of the manifesto and Giovanna's and Giuliana's husband have met. Nicola several times because he was going up and down from Baghdad to here, and really, I mean, everybody trusted him and appreciated the fact that he risked his life to save Giuliana. So that was, it was a real shock when we were told that he was killed, and I mean, he was killed for a very courageous gesture because he covered Giuliana's body, who could have been killed otherwise.
Luciana Castellina, we'd like to ask you to wait for a moment. We have to break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about the significance of this death and talk about what it means in Italy, whose population has been very opposed to the occupation, although Prime Minister Berlusconi has been very much an ally of President Bush, and what this means. Please stay with us. Cinematic Orchestra here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Luciana Castellina, a well-known public intellectual in Italy, one of the founders of Il Manifesto, the newspaper of Giuliana Segrena. Also, Luciana Castellina was a member of the Italian Parliament. Talking about the attitude of people right now, what this means with a population very opposed to the occupation, but a prime minister, Berlusconi, who is very much an ally of President Bush.
Well, let's say that the population in general is very angry, not because they think that this was a deliberate killing. You know, I mean, there is an inquiry of the judges. It's an inquiry for murder, voluntary murder. They would say what really happened. Maybe we won't never know. But it's not because it was a deliberate act, but because people think that it was not just a casualty, an incident. It means that in Iraq they shoot, and they shoot to everybody without with great arrogance and with not taking into account the life of human beings. And this is the war. This is the result of the war, of the violence which the war brings. And, you know, that the majority of the Italian population has been against the war, and all the polls have given this result, and we had perhaps the biggest demonstration for peace in Italy. So you can imagine that now, I mean, people have a really, you know, a sense of anger, and again, and that the idea that you have to pull back the occupation, if the Italy military presence in Iraq is very, very strong. Well, why should we stay there, by the way? Because not only because we are against the war, but because it means that we count nothing. We don't have a say if an American patrol can shoot through a car without thinking seriously about what they were doing when they had been, everybody had told them that they were aiming to the airport, so they were perfectly informed it was not at a checkpoint, and so on. And this idea, you know, that of the violence which the war brings, and that war never brings a new and better society. This is very strong, and people are really very angry. You can feel it in the among the people who were attending his funeral. This anger.
Do you think this could mean that the Italian troops, 3,000 of them, that they could be called home?
Well, you know, I am not very optimistic about that, because Berlusconi is probably the best ally of Bush, and I don't think he's going to do it. But his position is now more difficult than it used to be because of what happened, you know.
We're talking to Luciana Castellina about the death of the military intelligence chief who saved the life of Giuliana Segrena by throwing his body on top of hers in a car as U.S. troops opened fire. You had said that you don't think that she was targeted, but Giuliana Segrena herself has raised serious questions about this in interviews and in her writing. You've spoken to Giuliana today?
Yes, of course. I have spoken with Giuliana, of course. Giuliana herself, she says, I don't know. What is important of what Giuliana said, that they were not at the checkpoint, that they were not going fast, that they were already within the area of the airport, and that... And then there is another agent of the Secret Services, which was with the Giuliana in the same car, and which said the same things, and he confirmed that the American authorities had been perfectly informed. By the way, it would be impossible otherwise. Again, I come back, it doesn't mean that it was deliberate, but it means that it was there are shootings against human beings made like that without thinking twice, you see. This is a terrible thing. I mean, we know now about Giuliana because she was Italian, because we had an important man of the Secret Services which had been killed. But how many others have been killed in the same conditions? How many? Hundreds of thousands, perhaps. That is what comes out from this, what happened.
Luciana Castellina, what about the ransom that is reportedly paid? Also in the case of the Simonas, when they were released, this issue was raised with officials in Italy anonymously saying, yes, we think they were worth it.
I hear you very badly, so I don't know if I'm answering your question, because it's very far, your voice is very far. But anyway, you mean what about those who kidnapped them?
The issue of Italy paying ransom.
Yes. If it's what? Well, you see, I think first of all it was. To pay a ransom and save lives in the conditions of that war, it's correct. You have to do it. If the journalists, you have to protect the life of journalists who are going and speaking to the people. Otherwise, the result would be that we wouldn't have any journalists anymore, or only the embedded journalists. If you want people to stay there and go and talk to people and give information about them, we have to guarantee them, their life and the freedom to do their job, which is so important for democracy. So I think that it was worthwhile paying the ransom, and you always have to do it when lives are in danger, you know, and in a situation like that one, of course, I think. And this, I think, it's also a popular feeling that people think that this was correct to do so in both cases.
Finally, Luciana, what do you think this means for the future of the very close relationship between Berlusconi and Bush? And do you think something unpredictable can happen at this point?
Well, I don't think so, really. You know, the coalition is so strong, and Berlusconi has made a point of honor of being the best friend, personal friend and ally of Mr. Bush. And so I... But let's say that the option of the war in Iraq, who was not popular at the beginning, is becoming less and less popular, and less, I mean, more and more unpopular, let's say. And this is something which, of course, will make the position of Berlusconi more difficult, more embarrassed, although unfortunately, I don't think he's going to drive the conclusions he should drive.
Luciana Castellina, I want to thank you very much for being with us, and also note whatever the real story is behind the shooting of Juliana Segrena and the killing of the intelligence official who helped to save her life through his own death. This seems to be a story all too often that takes place in Iraq, where you have a situation of U.S. soldiers opening fire. So often we get different stories, or perhaps more often than not, especially if it's Iraqis who are killed, we don't even hear the other side. In this case, we hear at least that there is a dispute of the story. I want to thank you very much for being with us, Luciana Castellina, well-known public intellectual in Italy, one of the founders of Giuliana Segrena's newspaper, Il Manifesto. Luciana Castellina was a member of the Italian Parliament as well as the European Parliament. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we broadcast on over 300 stations around the country, Pacifica and NPR stations, public access and PBS stations, as well as both satellite networks on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And you can read transcripts and also see and hear the program at democracynow.org, a full archive there. And we are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. The presidents of Syria and Lebanon are meeting today to give formal approval to a two-phase pullback of Syrian troops stationed on Lebanese territory. The pullback was announced on Saturday by the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad after weeks of international pressure and demonstrations in Lebanon. The first phase is expected to begin after the meeting, with troops moving east into the Bekaa Valley. Up to 5,000 of Syria's 14,000 troops in Lebanon are deployed outside the Bekaa Valley. The U.S. has demanded all the troops leave Lebanon by May in time for elections, but Lebanon's most powerful and only armed party, Hezbollah, called for peaceful protests Tuesday in support of Syria and warned of mayhem if Syrian troops were to leave. Hezbollah leader Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah told a news conference Sunday, quote, "The aim of America and Israel is to spread chaos in Lebanon and to find excuses for foreign intervention." Joining us in our studio today is filmmaker Afamia Kadour. She made the film Leaded Unleaded about a May 2004 military assault on a poor slum area around Beirut. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you describe the situation right now in Beirut and after the killing of the former prime minister?
Well, it's kind of very messy, the situation, because people are mobilized in the streets. People are very anxious about what's going to happen next after the assassination, and you know, people, there are all these propaganda that the Lebanese want the Syrians out of Lebanon at this point, and we witnessed this sort of bourgeois revolution last week. That and people believe truly, the people who went to the streets, they genuinely believe that they are letting the Syrians out. But I think the situation is more complex than that, because there are foreign interests in the country who want to replace the Syrian presence and their interference in the internal politics with either French or American interference. Okay. And this is very dangerous,
Can you explain what you mean? What are the sides in Lebanon right now? Yeah. For and against Syria being there? Yeah. Is that the way it breaks down?
Actually, I would say that all Lebanese people want the Syrians outside the country.
They want them out.
Yes, they want them out. But the difference in how things are getting revealed now to the international press is that people who are allying with Syria at this point, they are aware that if the Syrians pull out now and under the terms of the Americans and the French and, of course, the Israelis, this means that Syria will become isolated. This means that Hezbollah, the only force that defeated the Israelis in Lebanon, will be disarmed. And this means that the sectarian system in Lebanon will be kept. This is not a fight to change the political system in Lebanon. So this in no means reflects the wills of the Lebanese people. And so, yeah, I would say the Syrians have a violent history in Lebanon. Every person in the country suffered from their presence and their interference. But what's happening is that we are treating Syria as if it is one body, as if it is, we treat the people and the state the same way. There are Syrian workers that, you know, they are very poor workers who work in very poor conditions in the country. 11 of them got killed after the assassination of Hariri, and nobody mentioned this. There is an upsurge of fascism and racism against those people, and I think this ought to be known. I would say also that the Syrians want their troops out because they don't want to interfere in this way in the politics. But the positive thing about not their presence in the country, but about their alliance with the Lebanese is that they were supporting Hezbollah, and what's more important actually is that they are facing Israel. They hindered for a long time the signing of a peace treaty according to the terms of the Israelis and the Americans, and this is what's more important. Mm-hmm. And I think
how is Hezbollah seen in Lebanon?
Hezbollah is a very well organized political party. It's very well respected because it has no corruption. But at the same time, it's a totalitarian political party. So there is no white or black. There is no evil political party and a good political party. They have done a great job by defending the borders of Lebanon, by defeating the Israelis, and all the Lebanese people, they thank them for this. They were the only power. Even our army did not interfere in all the attacks of the Israelis against Lebanon. It was always Hezbollah who were trying to defend the country.
Of course, Israel calls it a terrorist organization.
Of course, but this is, it's a guerrilla organization. It's not a state organization. And there is a difference between terrorism of a state and terrorism of people. I would call the Israeli state or the international defense forces of Israeli as a terrorist organization.
Will Hezbollah lose its power if Syrian troops pull out?
It's very hard to tell, because I think Hezbollah have the power to mobilize many people in the country, especially now. Because before the assassination of Hariri, the talk about the withdrawal of the Syrians was, people were more for this, because it didn't have all these implications about the foreign interference and the replacement of their presence with other international forces. But I think at this point, many people are reconsidering their positions, and Yeah, I don't know. I would be very hesitant to say that I know what will happen if the Syrian troops get out. But I think Hezbollah will resist very much. And I think they will get the support of many people inside Lebanon, even the secular people. Hmm.
Afamia Khadour, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Lebanese filmmaker who did the film Leaded Unleaded. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Ireland, where a trial is taking place, and we'll get it at its defendants at recess, Plowshares activists protesting the occupation of Iraq. And finally, we remember on this 40th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, those that were beaten at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we're going to go to Ireland to talk about the situation, a trial that is taking place, the trial of five peace activists beginning today in Dublin, Kieran O'Reilly, Deirdre Clancy, Damian Moran, Karen Fallon, and Nuan Dunlop were arrested February 3, 2003. They were arrested and faced charges stemming from an action at Shannon Airport in Clare County. Shannon Airport's a civilian airport that's been transformed into a pit stop for the U.S. military. An average of 13,000 U.S. troops stop at Shannon Airport each month. On February 3rd, the activists known as the Pit Stop Plowshares broke into a hangar at the airport and damaged a U.S. Navy warplane that was on the way to Iraq. They built a shrine with rosary and Islamic beads, a Quran, a Bible, and photographs of Iraqi children. They face sentences of up to 10 years imprisonment. We're joined now on the telephone from Dublin by Kieran O'Reilly, who is currently on trial, joining us during a break in the trial. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kieran.
Good morning.
Can you talk about the trial today, what you did and what you're being charged with?
Yeah, the day began with over 200 people walking to the court from the GPO in O'Connell Street. We were joined by Bishop Gumbleton of Detroit, Buddhist monks and members of the Iraqi community, as well as a lot of American anti-war activists who have come over to show solidarity at the trial, and British activists. Basically, today the jury was chosen, and the judge will be chosen tomorrow, and we will have court time until the 18th of March with a day off for St. Patrick's Day on the 17th. So the trial is now underway.
Can you talk about what you did on February 3rd?
Yeah, the action was a plowshares action. Plowshares actions began in the United States in 1980 by Phil and Dan Berrigan and others. We're a pacifist movement. We made our way into Shannon Airport that had become increasingly militarized over the previous 12 months before February 2003, and made our way to a hangar where a U.S. Navy warplane, logistical plane, was housed. We took with us simple household hammers. One of them had been used in four other plowshares actions and had been kindly returned by the police force after each community was either released or acquitted. And we began to disarm the plane. Now, we're charged with $2.5 million criminal damage without reasonable excuse. We think our action was quite reasonable. Since our action, over 100,000 Iraqi people, mostly women and children, have been killed. Over 1,500 U.S. military personnel, most who would have passed through Shannon on their way to their deaths, have been killed. And of course, over 10,000 evacuated with serious injuries. So we feel that we did an act of conscience, that that was our judgment at the time, and we're quite prepared to come into this court to speak to that.
So are you not denying the charges that have been brought against you?
The charges are $2.5 million U.S. criminal damage and I think 200 euros to the hangar's window. And we're hoping to call witnesses such as Kathy Kelly, who's with us from Voices in the Wilderness, who broke the sanctions on Iraq throughout the 90s. And Gulf War veteran Kelly Doherty is traveling over, the recent Iraq War veteran, to also add evidence. So we're hoping to put the war on trial. We have a website, waronTrial.com, which will update people as the trial progresses.
Kieran O'Reilly, I understand Bishop Gumbleton is standing next to you, if you wouldn't mind putting him on the telephone.
Fine, thank you.
Bishop Gumbleton, the Bishop of Detroit. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bishop Gumbleton.
Thank you very much.
Can you talk about why you're in Dublin right now and not Detroit?
Because I'm here to support the plowshares, plowshares people who tried to prevent the U.S. plane from delivering equipment and military personnel to Iraq. They were opposed to the war there, and I've been very opposed to the war since 1990 and continue to try to do everything it can to get the U.S. out of Iraq, and this is one more action in that direction.
What do you say to those, say, they're involved in violent property damage?
Well, I think a long-time answer to that has been, if you were in Germany in World War II, would you not have tried to stop the trains carrying people to the death camps or stop the chemicals from going there? And obviously, I think people wish they would have. And so sometimes in order to save life, you have to take property and prevent it from being misused.
The plowshares activists in this country hardly get any national network or mainstream media attention when they're tried or for their actions. What kind of coverage is there right now of this Pit Stop Plowshares trial?
It was pretty impressive this morning. When I got here, there were a number of news people here. I've done probably four or five interviews already. For the Catholic papers, but also for the Times, the Irish Times, and radio program also. And so there, I think it isn't something that is, disregarded as much as perhaps it is in the States. Here it's maybe making better news.
Could you put Kieran O'Reilly back on the phone, Bishop?
Sure.
And thank you for joining us, Bishop Gumbleton of Detroit.
Well, thanks for covering.
Thank you. Standing in solidarity with the plowshares activists in Dublin on trial today. Kieran O'Reilly is one of those activists who's on trial. Kieran, are you with us?
Yes, I am, yeah.
Last question. This is not your first plowshares action. Can you talk about what you did on the eve of the Persian Gulf War?
Yeah, on New Year's Day, 91, which is actually in the Catholic tradition, the World Day of Peace, myself, Bill Frankelstreit, Sue Frankelstreit from the Washington, D.C. Catholic Worker, and Moana Cole from New Zealand made our way to Griffiths Air Force Base and managed to disarm a B-52 bomber that was on 20-minute scramble alert and put it out of action for the next 2 months when the killing spree over Iraq occurred. And it's nice to know that Griffith Air Force Base today is free of all weapons, and I think Woodstock 99 happened there. So we went to prison for 13 months, and then I got the more traditional punishment of transportation to Australia. I was deported from the States. In 98, I was part of a ploughshares community that went to a new uranium mine in Australia and disabled uranium mining equipment. We had a growing awareness through the 90s of how depleted uranium munitions were being used, and not only injuring the people they were aimed at, but also the servicemen and women who employed them. So that was very much a witness against the use of depleted uranium, which, of course, was used again in this recent war.
And I was just looking at a picture of you together with, well, the now Timorese president, Xanana Gusmao.
Yeah, I first came to this part of the world from Australia because four women were on trial in Liverpool. They were in jail disarming a Hawk fighter that British Aerospace was selling to the Indonesian military to use against the people of East Timor. And Xanana Gusmao, of course, was in prison for 6 years in Jakarta at that point. And they're acquitted by a Liverpool jury who resonated with their act of conscience, £2.5 million worth of criminal damage they were charged with. I think that was the first acquittal for a ploughshares community, so it's very much part of East Timorese folklore that ploughshares witness now.
Well, Kieran O'Reilly, I want to thank you for joining us during the break in your trial today, the Pit Stop Ploughshares.
Thank you, Democracy Now!
As we turn now from Dublin to Selma, Alabama. Today is the 40th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, the historic Voting Rights March in Selma, Alabama. Thousands walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge to commemorate the anniversary yesterday. Among the marchers were Coretta Scott King, the wife of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who led the march. She said, quote, "The freedom we won here in Selma and on the road to Montgomery was purchased with the precious blood of many." On March 7, 1965, Alabama state troopers and Dallas County sheriff's deputies used billy clubs, tear gas, and cattle prods to stop some 600 black marchers from reaching Montgomery in a bid for voting rights. A second march 2 weeks later, under the protection of a federal court order led by Dr. King, went 50 miles from the bridge over the Alabama River to the steps of the state capitol in Montgomery. Among those attending the commemoration ceremonies this weekend were Georgia Congressmember John Lewis, who was there 40 years ago, as well as singer Harry Belafonte, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Lyndon Johnson Robb, whose father, President Lyndon Johnson, signed the Voting Rights Act into law in 65. Speaking on Sunday, Lewis said, quote, "President Johnson signed that act, but it was written by the people of Selma." We're joined now on the phone by Joanne Bland, Executive Director of the National Voting Rights Museum, joining us on the line from Selma, Alabama. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning. How are you?
Very good to have you with us. You were there 40 years ago?
Yes, I was. And here we are today, 40 years later, talking about it.
Can you talk about what happened 40 years ago, March 7th, 1965?
Please remember that I was only 11 years old in 1965. The ins and outs and why we were there, I had no idea. My grandmother began taking us to mass meetings when I was 8 years old. And so I guess I should say I grew up in struggle. I thought it was a way of life. But today, 40 years ago, March 7th, I was at Brown Chapel, AME Church. This is my church. I grew up in that church. But my sister was inside. I had no idea that there may be some violence. I probably was outside. As I say, I was only 11. But when the marchers lined up, I got in the line because my sister made me, and she wanted me to stay with her. And but I didn't. I wanted to be with my friends. So I saw a group of my friends, and I got in the area they were in. So my sister wound up near the front, and I wound up about midway. When we cleared the bridge, topped the bridge, I saw the policeman, and I knew we were not going to Montgomery. So I being a warrior, I knew the procedure. I knew that we would kneel in prayer, and after prayer, go back to the church. We kept waiting for the front to go down because I was too far back to really hear anything that was said down front. But suddenly we heard screams and gunshots, and we thought what I thought were gunshots. And the people started screaming, and people turned, and then the police came in from behind, and on the sides. We were completely surrounded, and they just started beating people. People were being trampled, not only by the police and the horses, but by each other trying to get away. It was just pandemonium. It was horrible. Blood was everywhere on the bridge. The screams is what I remember the most. And the horses that were so afraid that they were real to try to get away from the people. And these men relentlessly plowing the horses into the crowd. And the gunshots I heard turned out to be tear gas canisters exploding. And then the tear gas burning your eyes and can't breathe, you can't see. I mean, we panicked and couldn't get away. People were laying everywhere. You were tripping over people that at the time your mind registered that they were dead. In fact, the last thing I remember on that bridge is seeing this lady being trampled. And I don't know whether it's the sound of her head or my head hitting that pavement, but that's the last thing I remember when I awakened and I was in a car on the Selma side of the bridge, in the back of a car, and my sister was in the car, and she was crying. And when I became fully awake, I realized it was not her tears falling on my face. It was her blood. She was 14 and had been beaten on the bridge and had wounds that required stitches. So it was awful. I'll never forget it as long as I live.
Did you end up going to jail? You were 11?
Yeah, but we didn't go to jail that day. I had gone to jail lots of times before then. We were marched from our churches to the courthouse and to try to get adults in, and in protest. And when suddenly to try to stop us, they start putting us in jail. Now, at 11 years old, I don't remember anybody ever asking me how old I was, and I know I was not the youngest person there. Nobody, if you were there, you were arrested. So I went to jail 13 times by the time I was 11, and those are the ones we can document, not that I remember all of them, but those are the ones I can document.
Joanne Blaine, as we wrap up the program and we only have a minute, your thoughts 40 years later on this 40th anniversary of the Selma March.
Say it again.
Your thoughts 40 years later.
I think these commemorations are important because our struggle from 40 years ago is nearly the same today. We were struggling for the right to vote. Just the right to have that right that was supposedly given. Today, we're still fighting to retain that right. As we come together on this weekend and the rest of the week, we have to renew that will to struggle to keep going until all is right and when all Americans can enjoy the freedoms afforded by the laws of this land. I think it's very, very important, and I'm ecstatic that so many people came, that we're not just struggling alone. It's a lot of people out there who are aware of the situation and who want to struggle to make it right, and I thank America for that.
Joanne Blaine, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the National Voting Rights Museum, speaking to us from Selma, Alabama, on this 40th anniversary of the Selma March. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like transcripts or a copy of today's program, you can go to our website, democracynow.org. You can get video or audio copies of the program by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Tomorrow, for International Women's Day, we will spend the hour with Wangari Maathai, this year's Nobel Peace Prize winner. That does it for the show. On Thursday, Democracy Now! Will be in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That is March 10th. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.